evening, it gives me enormous pleasure to welcome a very highly distinguished oceanographer. In fact, one of our most distinguished living ocean explorers today. He's been at Scripps for over half a century. And he knows more about physical oceanography than most people dream of. In fact, I've learned so much about Joe Reed that if I started telling you half of it, there'd be no time for him to give his talk tonight. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about him. He graduated from the University of Texas with a BA in mathematics in 1942, and then during the World War II, he served as an officer aboard a U.S. Navy destroyer escort in the North Atlantic and later in the South Pacific. And he says that one of his last duties at the end of the war was to look for survivors among the atolls and islands of New Guinea, and that actually what he found was a lifelong fascination with the ocean. And so in 1948, he came to Scripps Institution of Oceanography and has been here ever since. And he's engaged in the studies of large-scale circulation of water in the ocean, first at the surface and then in all the oceans, top to bottom. He's done so many things that I'm just going to pick out one or two. He was on the very first Calcoffee cruise. That's the program that is the most comprehensive investigation of a marine environment, and that's just off the coast here. And he led the NORPAC expedition in 1955, and that was the most ambitious oceanographic survey of its time. It involved 19 research vessels and 14 different countries, including the U.S., Japan, and Canada. He's had numerous awards. One of them particularly is the Alexander Agassiz Gold Medal from the National Academy of Sciences. But an award that has given him particular pleasure and may tell you a little bit about him is the Stuffed Albatross Award. And that's from their very interesting scientific organization, the American Miscellaneous Society. And it was given for his outrageous insistence that ocean circulation models should bear some resemblance to reality. And it's that reality is one of the things that makes him so remarkable, that he has gone to such amazing lengths to discover what that reality of ocean circulation really is. And I think one of the most wonderful accolades that I've heard about him is what his peers and his students say. Everybody has just enormous admiration for him and his work. And one professor here at UCSD, Bob Guza, said, "Oh, goodness, Joe Reed, he has a crazy heart." So, a crazy man with a crazy heart. So I thought, what does he mean, a crazy man? And what he meant by that was that he would go to any lengths to understand the science and to find out the science so that we understand some of the basic fundamental principles of physical oceanography, how water circulates through the ocean. He went to the Antarctic in the middle of the Antarctic winter, in pitch dark and freezing cold, to understand how water circulates in that area. So we owe an enormous debt to Joe Reed to being one of the real true explorers of our time. And I'll stop there, because otherwise there won't be any time to hear his talk tonight. Joe, without further ado.
Thank you for that statement. How nice if it were all true. I am a physical oceanographer, and in the process of studying the circulation of the ocean, I've come across a couple of things that will be of a wider interest. I'd like to tell you about them. Now, I'm not a historian, and I may make a mistake here and there, and I hope you'll correct me. My only qualification for this sort of presentation is that I was a navigator on a small vessel a long time ago in World War II, and they had both Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and I had to find a way through some badly charted areas for the southwestern Pacific. That was before GPS, and our own offshore navigation was done by celestial observations. We did have a fathometer. We found a couple of islands that didn't match their position on the charts, and perhaps that's what started me on this subject. Now, much of what I'm going to say is already known to you, Perhaps you haven't strung together in the way that I will. Although winds and currents did play an important and dominating part in the voyages of discovery, it was usually not a planned part. People had to take their luck as they found it and work it out as they went along. Well, what did people know about the land, sea, winds, and currents at various stages of history? The technical information they had, which must have been substantial, has not been passed down to us. Now, there exist so-called sailing directions for the Red Sea and parts of the Mediterranean, dating from several centuries B.C., but no modern sailor would think that they are any good. He would probably think those are notes for merchants handling cargo at various ports instead of seamen trying to bring vessels into and out of harbors. What they didn't have is such things as soundings, winds, hazards of navigation, holding ground, and the historians who copied these things down, I suppose, thought those were not very important and left them out. Of course, the pilots themselves must have a great deal of this information, but it didn't come down on paper or parchment or papyrus. Well, what do we know of the technical knowledge of the ancients so far as geography and navigation is concerned? Civilization began, according to Western authorities, in the fertile Tigris and Euphrates Valley, Mesopotamia, and along the Nile, and there must have been a great deal of river travel on rafts, canoes, or small boats, but it was a long time before people could build good enough ships to voyage even in the Mediterranean and Persian Gulf, where they were never far from land and could hug the coasts and find their position that way. Well, what did they know of the Earth at that time, its shape and size, its climate and terrain? They reasoned it was round because ships disappeared below the horizon and the continents disappeared as you went away from them. The day's length varied north and south. Constellations were at different altitudes north and south, and also they saw an eclipsis of the moon that cast the Earth's shadow on the moon. So they knew it was round. That was not a problem. The size was the next stage. The first recorded measurement of the size of the Earth was by Eratosthenes, who was a librarian in the library at Alexandria at about 200 B.C. We don't think of librarians usually as doing this sort of thing. They're musty, dusty types who just keep filing the books or misfiling them. But this fellow did something else. Geometry was well along by that time, and he realized the size of the Earth could be measured by observing the altitude of the sun at noon on the same day at two points a known distance apart. He'd been told that on the summer solstice, June 21st, there was a place in the south, about where up the Nile, about where the Aswan High Dam is now, where the sun was directly overhead at noontime. It shone straight down a well. You could see the bottom down there. Knowing this, he need only measure the angle the sun made with a plumb line at some other place and compare them. The angular difference would be the difference in latitude between the two places. If I may draw that, here's half of the Earth with the North Pole here. And at this particular place, on a certain day, the sun's rays went directly in here and pointing to the center of the Earth. He realized that if he could measure the angle the sun made with a plumb line at some other point, up here the plumb line, and here the sun's rays parallel to there, that angle would meet down here. This angle here is the same as that angle there because parallel lines meeting one line. And that angle is the fraction of a circle that compares to this distance here to the circumference of the Earth. And he came out with 1/50th of a circle for the angular difference. Well, that gave you a problem, because what was the land distance? Well, it was known to be 50 camel marches. We didn't know exactly how far a camel marched. Now, it turns out the distance is about 500 miles. If a camel marches 10 miles a day, why, then we come out with exactly the right answer. And one of these wonderful eccentric Englishmen, Rennell, thought he would test this, so he got a bunch of camels and marched them around. Unfortunately, he found that they marched more than 10 miles a day. But then he realized selective breeding must have improved the marching capabilities of camels in the previous 2,000 years. Anyway, the thing that he measured was not the size of the earth, but the angle there from which it could be calculated. Having established that the earth was round and recognized that the sun doesn't pass directly overhead and everywhere at noon, they developed the idea of climate. They knew it was warm toward the equator and off south of Greece, and cold farther north. They thought perhaps that the temperature at the equator would be too high for anyone to live or cross. This is offered of an example of what the Greeks could do. The tragedy is they didn't work on the real ocean. They worked only on the Mediterranean around the edge. It doesn't have any tides or big steady currents that they could get their teeth into. Well, what about the kind of ships they had? The ships, the first that we see have drawn. And we don't have any realistic pictures of ships in the ancient period. They just, the earliest we have are some ship models in Egypt, about 3000 BC, but they are not the kind of ships that people went to sea on. They're galleys, the kind you see in a movie about Mark Antony and Cleopatra or so. You would never go to sea in one of those. You paddle up and down the Nile a little bit. The ships they used are probably familiar with you to the movies. One thinks of a small vessel rowed with a one square sail amidships, but mostly propelled by the rowers. Rowing is hard work and takes many men and has a very small payload. Can't go on day and night. In the Mediterranean in the evening, they simply drew the ship up on the beach and cooked and slept ashore, and invented tales of the Cyclops and Scylla and Charybdis and so forth. They had no compasses and navigated by going along the shore and island hopping. How capable were these vessels of travel on the open sea? Let's look at some of them and at the areas, distances, winds, and currents they had to deal with. This has a drawing of a model found in one of the pharaoh's tombs, and it's a handsome ship, I think, but with that many oars, it can't carry a big payload, and that sail in a 4-7 wind in the open sea with any swell would be fatal. That was for going up and down the Nile short distances, I think. I believe this is a picture of the kind of merchant ship that the Romans used to carry the grain from Alexandria, from Africa to Rome. But I don't like it. I don't know. I'll have to ask Chip what he thinks of that as a cargo vessel. Furthermore, they have to go upwind. The wind is mostly from the west prevailing, and Alexandria is a little bit east of Rome. And how they work the way up there, in the summer season, there are a few easterly winds that do occur, but they must have had a tough time. They made it work somehow. I don't know, though. Well, look what they had to deal with. These are the winds over the world. In December, there are changes in season, but what you can see is we have, in all high latitudes, we have winds from the west in all oceans, and in the low latitudes, we have the trade winds from the east, and those are not steady in the sense that you'll find it that way when you go there. They all vary day by day and season by season. if we put the currents resulting on them, we can see that there's a certain correspondence. They do follow the winds around these various gyres. And, of course, they have their strongest currents over on the western sides in all oceans. But the currents are, to some extent, downwind nearly everywhere. Now, of course, the landlocked ancients didn't know about these systems, but had to take the wind and current as they found them. The Phoenicians, a group from the Eastern Mediterranean, were a commercial seafaring people who had traded from the east end of the Mediterranean out to the Straits of Gibraltar. They brought back copper from the various places they could find it. Particularly, they got some from Cornwall in Britain. Whether they actually sailed around there to do it or had it carried across land to the Mediterranean, I don't know. But they were the best seafarers of their day. It was tin they were after, and there were only a few places where that available. They also brought back amber, which of course had to come from way up here, but that came overland down to the Mediterranean. Now, it is related by the Greek historian Herodotus about 450 BC that before his time, an Egyptian pharaoh, Necho, about 1200 BC, made various attempts at discovery. He tried to connect the Nile with the to the Red Sea across here, but he couldn't keep his canal from filling. He's most famous for having tried to see if ships could sail all the way around Africa. At that time, they didn't know whether Africa was a separate continent or was attached all the way across here. So he hired some Phoenicians to sail around. And according to the story, they set out from the Red Sea, and they stopped in Africa in the autumn and planted corn. What was autumn, you know? Going one hemisphere to another, you have to worry a little about what autumn is. And they were supposed to have returned after having sailed around Africa and back through the Straits of Gibraltar and home again. Now, they reported one thing that Herodotus does not believe and makes him doubt the whole story, and that is, they said that as they sailed around Africa, they had the sun on their right. That is, the sun was to the north of them at noontime, to the north. Here, around here, we never see the sun north at noontime. The sun is always south of us here because we're 32 degrees north, and the sun only gets 23 degrees off. Well, that's an interesting point, because if it isn't true that they said that, who would have stuck in that piece of information to the story aside? It's true, if they'd gone there, it would have been to the north. But did they make the trip? I wonder. Now, Herodotus, if he had a little bit more training in mathematics, would have understood this, but he didn't. He was a man of the humanities, and this represents one of the first schisms between men of the humanities and men of science. The geometry people would have explained this to me, but he'd apparently flunked geometry in high school. And if he and some mathematics professor at the university ever sat down over a beer and talked about this, they would know immediately that the ship had crossed the equator and that Africa could be circumnavigated. But it had to be another 1,500 years before this was really worked out. Now, the Vikings knew about the existence of Iceland, and by accident found Greenland, and one ship was blown to the North American continent. They tried to make settlements on Vinland, North America, as well as Iceland and Greenland, but they failed on Vinland. One of the problems was that their ships were not designed for such open voyages. Now, that is a Viking ship, the kind we see on all the paintings and we find dug up in various places in England and Norway. And it's a fine ship for some purposes, but it's not a cargo ship. And I'm not sure how good it would be for crossing the whole North Atlantic in the best season. That ship was designed for getting it filled up with armed men on one little bay, very quickly in good weather, rowing down or sailing down to the next bay, going ashore, killing the men, raping the women, stealing the cattle and the corn, and going home again. That's what Viking ships were designed for, and were apparently pretty good at it. But they did have a slightly larger ship, a Nor, a much broader beam, and that was at least capable of going to sea. It wasn't completely satisfactory because on one expedition to Greenland from Norway, only 15 out of 37 ships survived. And that was as bad as the convoy losses in World War II on that Murmansk run. It was upwind, up current, too much rowing, no room for family, stores, and cattle. The Vinland colonies did not succeed, so the Scandinavians moved southward to ravage England, France, and Ireland, and some parts of North Africa. It was a lot more fun than farming and rowing. Now, look at these dates. Eric the Red in 983, unknown about 874, and Leif Erikson in 1000. But the Vinland, the North American settlements did not survive. But Europe was climbing out of the Dark Ages about this time, and Europe had been made aware of the products of India and China, and they wished to swell the trickle of trade that between the Middle East through the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, and caravan routes north of the Black Sea. The Crusades took place in the 11th and 12th centuries, but they didn't succeed in breaking through, and in fact Constantinople fell to the Turks in 1453. In fact, as the Mohammedan Empire broke up, which had covered all the way from our present Middle East over to the Straits of Gibraltar and halfway up to Spain, after it broke up, there were many little countries there, each wanting its own tariff and rake-off on any of caravans and ships that went by. Can you imagine the major trade routes through the Red Sea and Persian Gulf being constricted or shut off by local political and religious squabbles? This would never happen in our more enlightened day. So small expeditions did find some of the offshore islands, by accident, I suppose. The Canary Islands in 1270, Cape Bojador, the Azores, and finally down to the Congo River in 1485. That's a medieval ship, bigger still. I still think it's overmasted. And that one's really overmasted, I think. I know, Chip, what do you think? And the real action began with a Portuguese, Prince Henry, who worked in Portugal from about 1420 till he died in 1460. Portugal is a tiny little land just on the west side of Spain, and the various trades that was coming through from India and China was all taken up by the countries in between. Portugal could not import anything through the Mediterranean, and its only chance of getting the wealth from the Indies was to find some other route. And he thought, possibly we can go around Africa. He hadn't read Herodotus. And he built better ships and tried to persuade his captains to go farther and farther down the coast of Africa. And one would go a little way and come back, and a little way and come back. The trouble was, you see, the currents and winds were so far farther this way that they lost their nerve. We're never going to get back, they thought. So Probably he had picked the wrong people. He said, give me a good skipper. Who did they get? The fellow who made had the most successful runs from Lisbon to Italy and back again, Lisbon to Naples and back again. Several cruises, very successful, making money. That's the kind of man we want. No, he probably got a fat and lazy fellow who didn't want to take any chances. Only after his death did Bartholomew Diaz finally make the Cape of Good Hope and return, saying he'd seen the Indian Ocean. How he knew that he had seen the Indian Ocean when he got here, you know. You don't see the whole ocean. How did he know it wasn't just another big bay? Anyway, he said it was the Indian Ocean, and he was right. Perhaps he found out from the Arab that he picked up in Madagascar, who told him about the monsoons and told him not to go in this time of year, wait till the summer monsoons happen, and then he could get up there. Anyway, after Diaz, they did manage to get to India and establish a trade there. The problem was that the Portuguese did not have anything to trade for the stuff they wanted. Gold and silver was the only thing they had. They did not manufacture anything that the Indians and Chinese couldn't do better. So what do? They simply took over the trade there. Only their ships could carry the cargoes. They became immensely wealthy because all of the things that were provided in India were carried in Portuguese ships, and they had a monopoly. Well, anyway, when Diaz got back to after his rounding of Africa, there was a fellow named Columbus waiting in Spain, who's trying to sail around the world to find it. And he knew that when the Portuguese had found a good route to India and locked it off, but he couldn't use it, he was not going to get any money from the Portuguese anyway, so he went to Spain, and for reasons we shall never understand, they funded his trip. Now, he proposed to sail west from Spain to China, Japan, and India. And it turned out that he gave a proposal that wouldn't work. That is, people knew the size of the Earth fairly well by that time. Just this is the North Pole, and let's look down at the Earth. Here is Spain over here, and here is Borneo over here, and here are the West Indies over here. And that distance was simply too great. It proved to be something like 13,000 miles, which no ship could possibly make. Well, what was his solution to that? He recalculated the size of the Earth. But that wasn't enough. He did it again over here. It's a smaller one, Spain. But the distance over to Borneo here was obviously wrong. It's all done with camel marches, you know. Therefore, it's really a much greater distance. It turned out that was about 17,000 miles to Borneo over here, and that left only about 4,000 miles from Spain to India. He should have been in real estate or something like that, you know. But how this flew, I don't know, you see, because people knew that was wrong. Whether there was other information that Columbus had about there being some land over there, I don't know. We'll never understand how that came about. But in fact, he made the trip. Now, Mark Twain once wrote that while Columbus's discovery of America was remarkable, it would have been even more remarkable if he'd sailed west from Spain and missed it. But you see, Mark Twain was only a steamboat pilot and didn't know anything about this. Actually, some people had tried to sail west, but you can't do it. That feature there is the tracks of a bunch of logs. They used to cut, this was the 19th century, people used to cut big trees in Maine, put them in log rafts, and pull them down the coast here and cut them up down here. But a big storm hit this one, and the log raft broke up. And that's where the logs were observed later on. They couldn't be recovered. And clearly, any ship trying to sail against those winds and currents was not going to make it. Furthermore, a lot of ships became derelicts. Their crews abandoned them for one reason or another. And this is the tracks that they went. The only way to get... See, one of them at least came over the way over here and drifted down again. But you could not sail west, no matter what Mark Twain said, you couldn't sail west and get it. The one idea that Columbus threw in was that to go west from Spain, he'd better start and go down to pick up the trades. Now, how he knew about the trades, we don't know. The ships he had were the Santa Maria, the Niña. It was a square rigger too, except it could be re-rigged for fore and aft sails. It was much better at going against the wind when they were exploring the islands. Then, as he dropped south from Spain and picked up the wind, and then, having sailed across and found something, which he always maintained was the East Indies, he didn't go back the way he came because he knew the winds were against him. He'd just been through there. He sailed north, picked them up, and really made a good voyage back to Spain. Now, just imagine, October 11th or 12th is when he landed. That's the middle of the hurricane season. You know, if they got a hurricane when his fleet was over there, he would never have been hurt again. He just had the luck of the whatever it was. His route is as good as could be chosen today. He made a fast and safe voyage, and even in September and October, he survived. Well, what did the referees think of his proposal now? Suppose I'd said, he can't do it, the distance is different, and all of a sudden he came back saying, I did. And he brought some Indians to prove it. Well, now the Portuguese were scared. For all they knew, Columbus had found the East Indies. And could possibly sail west across the Pacific. And Magellan then did undertake to do that for Spain. Magellan was a Portuguese who had got in trouble in managing the PX or something in the Portuguese army, and he deserted to Spain. And he had actually been to the East Indies before on one of the trips the Portuguese had taken over here. So he knew something about that. But they gave him three ships, and he simply sailed from Spain with those. And not knowing how far he was going to have to go, he went up every river mouth looking for the Pacific Ocean. And he had trouble with the crew. They didn't like being commanded by Portuguese, and he had to stop and hang a couple of Spaniards here. And then his luck getting through the Straits of Magellan was a remarkable feat. Anyway, he knew what the winds were there, and he knew he was not going to be able to go west in these latitudes, so he went up, picked up the trades, and His ships barely made it into the Philippine Islands there. They were in bad shape. He got things even worse by getting involved in a local war and was killed. Now he had three ships. They did have a good navigator. It turned out that the universities in Italy were producing a surplus of master's degree people in those days, more than the banks and merchants could handle. And since they did know something about mathematics, or at least arithmetic and geometry, they could be hired on to be pilots. They could at least, by observing the sun, tell their latitude, and estimating the speed, they could estimate how far they were making it on tacks. And one of these fellows was available to take them the rest of the way. Well, it turned out that these ships were in terrible shape now. One of the three tried to sail back eastward across the ocean. It was never heard from. Another one simply gave itself up and turned into the Portuguese, and they were never heard of again. But one fellow managed to get the other ship in a terrible situation all the way back to Spain, having come around Africa to do it. So he was the first fellow to circumnavigate the world, or at least his ship did. He was the first one who'd been all the way around, because he'd been there before from the east, and he came there from the west and died. Well, the trouble is, having found the way to the Philippines, that didn't do any good, because they didn't have a way to get back. And the Spaniards could certainly sail from Spain over here, or they could build their ships over here and sail across here, but they couldn't get back against those winds. And there were some Spaniards who had been waiting there 40 years for the next ship home. There was just no way to do it. They couldn't go around, couldn't go back the other way, because the Portuguese would stop them. Well, one man, Urdaneta, who'd been one of the people who did go to the Philippines on a Spanish ship as a sailor, stayed in the Philippines so long that he became a priest. But he still remembered enough about sailing that he kept saying, why don't we go back the way Columbus did, go north and pick up these others. And finally, he did get a ship. And he had become a priest? That's what he was doing. Here was this priest, not in command of the ship. But when the ship finally did get into Acapulco, after terrible problems, most of the crew died, scurvy, thirst, and starvation. The only man alive who could steer the ship into Acapulco was Urdaneta, 80 years old. By George, there was a man. And with that system, set up the galleon passages. That is, the Spaniards didn't go around Cape Horn anymore. They simply went back and forth across here, carrying Mexican and Peruvian silver, over and trading them in the Philippines for the things that India and the East Indies had: silk, spices. And that was a very successful route that lasted for 200 years. It was maintained until the Napoleonic Wars, when the Spanish Empire broke up. They built larger ships to do this. But now the English were in trouble, because Spain and Portugal and even Holland had got into the act for the East, but England hadn't. But they had troubles with Spain, the merchants of London, with some financial help from the Queen, thought they could send a ship down to look for some land. It was supposed to be it was supposed that to balance Eurasia, there should be a big continent down here. But there wasn't, unfortunately. and it presumably would have as much wealth as the Indies had. Well, Drake was in command of this fleet, and they sailed down, and they also went up all the rivers looking for a passage to the Pacific. And that same place right there, Drake had to hang a couple of Englishmen who were giving him trouble. Same place that Magellan had. And he finally found that he could go through. He couldn't go through the Straits of Magellan. He had to go all around. And as he got around, he came across a gale. He was 6 weeks getting from here up to here. 6 weeks of the nastiest weather you can imagine. How they managed to stand it, I don't know. But anyway, he was now convinced that nobody was going to sail west in these latitudes. The winds were just not going to make it possible. Now, the Queen and a lot of merchants had put money into this venture. How was he going to justify his efforts? Well, okay. He gave up being a merchant, an explorer. He became a pirate. And he just down into every one of these little Spanish settlements along the west coast of South America, most of whom had been able to get a little silver and some pearls and things of that nature. And then how they managed it, I don't know, but off Acapulco, he intercepted a treasure ship coming back. How do you do this? No radio communication, no ship schedules you can follow. That must have been the greatest luck in the world that he found this thing, captured it. Now he couldn't go back this way, you see, because the Spaniards were awake. And he thought, well, can I go through the Northeast Passage up there? No, he didn't. He finally overhauled his ship here and then managed to sneak through the Spaniards and the Portuguese and came back with an enormous profit, of course. Well, that was the second circumnavigation, I think. Well, people learned more about these routes. We get to Captain Cook. Now, that was in 1772. The times had changed so much. The ships were very much better. They were able to navigate now. Cook could even find his longitude with an unspeakably nasty set of calculations he had to make after observing some things, but he could do it. He was a first-rate seaman. He had made his career by carrying coal down the east coast of England in winter, and any fellow who could do that for several years and survive was a first-rate seaman. Anyway, he went down on this trip, had to go around this way, and then to search this domain, he went down south to see if he could find anything in that direction. He tried to find if there was an Antarctic continent, but he was always stopped by the ice. He couldn't get that far in. But he did cover this whole domain and convinced himself that there was no great continent down there that had gone missing. Well, this is the last slide in the sense that that's what they started with. And it really doesn't make mankind look too good. We did all these things, but most of our successful voyages were downwind and down current. You know, and how many people tried the wrong direction and were simply never heard of again? And what kind of heroes have we got? Well, of course, the big names are Columbus and Magellan and Drake, but I think we should keep Prince Henry the Navigator of Portugal in mind. And I like Urdaneta. Now, there was a man from a low position who managed to do something grand. Magellan was the only real swashbuckler of the lot, a professional soldier, who a foreign admiral of a reluctant and very frightened fleet, but managed to get it all done without his great determination they would never have succeeded, but he lost his life in a foolish little fuss in the Philippines. Thank you. I don't know whether I've left any time for questions or not.
Yeah, we certainly have time for questions. Please, a couple of questions. You're welcome.
Yes?
I've forgotten the sailor's name, but the young man who sailed the Dove single-handed around the world, that's now at Greenwich. Do you know what his route was? Do you remember?
I don't remember his name. Chipwood, if he'd heard it.
The first single-hander around the world. What is it?
Slocum?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Did he take the classic route?
Yes.
It was an old man.
Cook was a great cartographer, but wasn't Captain Bligh, his navigator on two of those expeditions?
Well, Bligh was assistant to, or just under Cook on the first two cruises, and he took over when Cook was killed, I think. Yes?
I might be wrong. My understanding is that there was a La Nina that actually assisted with the Pizarro's getting down the coast of South America on the western side. Something to do with the La Nina actually affecting the wind direction and making it, because it primarily goes south to north. But I guess in the La Nina year, it actually worked.
Well, yes, the trades come in from north and south, both there, and La Nina and El Nino certainly make a difference for a few weeks or months or a couple of years during that period, but the ships had to be able to manage that. Yes?
One of the historic pieces of navigational school, Henry the Navigator, two things, that a number of the Jewish astronomers and mathematicians fled Spain during the Inquisition and relocated into Portugal, and this gave them a resource. And the other point is the Portuguese, through various incentives, had discovered if you were trying to get back, you had to go way out to sea to the west and pick up those currents. And so
yes,
that was a military secret for, I gather, 50, 80, or 100 years, helped
yes.
by the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm. I had that in one of the slides that got missed up here. Sorry. Yes?
I'm curious when people discovered lime juice.
When people discovered lime juice.
Oh, it was in the 18th century, I think, but not everybody believed it. And it was not used by many ships, even after it was determined. Sauerkraut proved to be very good, too. Believe it or not, yes.
You have the currents going west and east, and at the equator, as I recall, having sailed through there, there's a null.
The doldrums are there. Yeah. I didn't have time to go into
How
that.
How did those ships get through the doldrums? We could hardly do it with an engine.
They just had to wait and wait and wait for a little fortunate gust of wind to move them back into the wind belts. Mm-hmm. It was tough.
There's a question way back there in the corner.
Is it your gap? Which country came through with the best boat design and architecture? Because suddenly it seemed like the Vikings just kind of faded out of the picture.
I'm sorry?
The Scandinavians.
Can you say it again, please?
Is the jury out on which country came through with the best boat design, ship design for navigation in the oceans? Because suddenly the Vikings seemed to kind of fade out of the picture, the Scandinavians.
You mean for ship design?
Yes.
Well, but after they gave up this business of just landing on and taking over lands there, they didn't get in big seagoing commerce.
Oh.
Those were the people who wanted big bottoms that would hold lots of cargo.
Perhaps one more question, Joe?
Yes?
Professor, what causes these winds and subsequent currents, and are they eternal?
I could list a... No, no. That's impossible to answer in the time available. Besides, a lot of it has not been quite settled. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.